Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Brad Dolan, Program Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your co-chair for today. We also like to welcome our listening and viewing audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Jeremy Baylinson. Jeremy Baylinson is founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab and an associate professor in the Department of Communication at Stanford University. Professor Baylinson's main area of interest is the phenomenon of digital human representation, especially in the context of immersive virtual reality. He also designs and studies collaborative virtual reality systems that allow physically remote individuals to meet in virtual space and explores the manner in which these systems change the nature of verbal and nonverbal interaction. Professor Baylinson's findings have been published in over 70 academic papers in the fields of communication, computer science, education, law, political science, and psychology. So let's welcome Professor Baylinson.
Hi, guys. I'm going to talk about 15 or 20 years worth of research that has culminated in a book that we've titled Infinite Reality. And to give you some background, I was trained as a cognitive psychologist. So I got my PhD at Northwestern running experiments on humans to understand how the mind works. I got very bored with that, so I left that field, and I was lucky enough to stumble into the world of virtual reality. So I've been running experiments on people in virtual reality and studying avatars since the late 90s. And there was a period of about 7 or 8 years where I would tell people what I did and they would laugh at me. They'd say, what is an avatar? What are you studying? Why is that important? And so for me to be able to come to a place like this, which is really, you know, setting the agenda for what's important and to be able to talk about this work, it's very special for me. So the book is called Infinite Reality, and I'd like you to think of it as a survival guide. How are we going to survive? How are children and our grandchildren going to survive this crazy world where everything is digital and people are spending more time in virtual spaces than physical ones? So that's the big idea behind today's talk. When you're in virtual spaces, there's no rules. You can look however you want. You can behave however you want. There's this illusion that everything you do is anonymous, and all of the rules that we have face-to-face can get thrown out of the window. So the main question in the 30 minutes we have today that I'm going to focus on from the book is, what happens when my virtual representation is different than my physical representation? So my avatar, this representation of me in digital space, I can make it look however I want. I can make it behave however I want. What are the consequences of this transformation, both to me, to the self, and to an audience, people that interact with me? And as I said, this is the book. I'm told we only have 8 copies for sale tonight, so that was a bit of an oversight, but you can go to Amazon and you can buy it there. And really the book is, I'm very proud of it. It's a very accessible way to, if you've heard the word avatar but you don't know what it is, this is the book that gives you the science behind it and tells you about really how it's going to affect your life. So, what is this guy doing? Besides looking extremely silly, what he's doing is walking the virtual plank. And what's going on in this video, every time he moves in the physical world, we're tracking his motion. So if he moves, steps forward 1 meter, we know that. If he rotates his head 3 degrees to the left, we know that. That's called tracking. His motions are tracked. We're then redrawing a world for him and showing it to his eyes and sending sound to his ears. So from his point of view, you see him on a carpet. He's forgotten the physical world is there, and what he's doing is walking a precarious plank. And in my new lab at Stanford, which just got finished about 6 months ago, the illusion is so compelling that 1 in 3 adults that do this, when they do it, I have to put my arms right around them because 1 in 3 adults fall down. They completely forget the physical world is there. We call this presence. The illusion is so compelling, we override their physical senses with virtual ones, and it's just stunning how good it's gotten. But what you probably noticed in this video, and why virtual reality has never been, it's always been something for science fiction people until recently, is that this guy has to wear this clunky helmet. And it puts marks on your head, and it's heavy, and it costs more than a new car. And that's why VR has always been this thing that hides in the background. We talk about it, but it's never actually gotten there. And all of that has changed. All of that has changed. And every VR guy in the history of VR, which is 30, 40 years in terms of the technology, has always said, next year, it's going to be in your living room. And I've never said that in my entire life. But I'm standing up here right now, and I'm telling you, next year, it's going to be in your living room. And there's two reasons for this, okay? Two reasons for this. The first is something called computer vision. And what you see here, how many of you or your children have something called the Microsoft Kinect in the house, all right? The Kinect is a revolutionary technology that says to track your motions, you don't have to wear all sorts of lights on your body or a stretchy suit. All you've got to do is be in the field of view of an infrared camera. And for the first time ever, to track your motions to an extremely sensitive degree, all you need to do is be in range of a camera. You don't have to wear anything on your body. So the tracking aspect of VR, knowing what you're doing to update the world, so to show that guy walking on the plank, you have to know what his foot's doing, and the Kinect solves that problem. The second thing is something called a lenticular auto stereo display. So how many of you guys have heard of the Nintendo 3DS? Half the school buses in America have this right now, and this is an object. You know those postcards that you wiggle around and you see stereo? It's a very expensive version of that that pops a hologram in front of you. We've got one in my lab right now that literally you can't tell if it's a person or a digitally rendered image. It is so compelling. So VR used to need this helmet, and Stanford just rebuilt me this insanely beautiful, expensive lab, and it's obsolete in a year because your motions are tracked by this video game. And this video game gives you a hologram in the middle of space. So everything we've always talked about with VR, Jaron Lanier, the founder of the technology, has said, no one's ever going to use VR if you've got to put crap on your head. If you've got to dedicate a room to it, no one's going to use it. And what we have now is the ability to create a compelling illusion that responds to your actions in something you hold in your hand. So VR is no longer just in the lab. It's everywhere. But as a social scientist, I study virtual people. So when subjects come in my lab, I take two photographs of them from the front and the side. After 15 minutes of using graphic software, I've got what I call a virtual bust. So this head model is a mesh that I've made from the two photographs of a subject. Once I've built this 3D model, I've got a head that captures about 96% of your facial variance. It's so real that I use it with the Federal Judicial Center to run police lineups. This thing looks just like you. But what happens with a digital object? So remember Napster, okay? Napster created a place for you to share virtual music. What happens with a virtual song? A, it lasts forever. B, you can make gazillions of copies of it for free. Now, apply that to humans. Once we've got you built, you're going to live forever. I can make millions of you. And the most critical thing is I can animate you to do whatever I want. So once your model is built, any action you can fathom, I can draw you doing it. So consider the case of Orville Redenbacher. Popcorn mogul, is that name familiar to you guys? Orville passed away, unfortunately, some time ago. His grandson gave the rights to an advertising agency to go through all the video, reconstruct a 3D model of Orville. You can go home and YouTube Orville Redenbacher or virtual. Built a model of him, so while he's passed away from the grave, Orville is still acting in commercials. And you can find one where he's dancing around with an iPod saying, this baby's light and fluffy and it holds 30 gigs just like my popcorn. So once you've got a 3D model built, it's around forever, and it can perform any action anyone can fathom. But to make you feel compelling, to make you feel like you're in VR, it can't just look like you, it's got to behave like you. And I just had the Microsoft people in my lab 3 days ago, and this is a product that I've always bragged about, which is here's a real-time video of you. This is that model I just built, and by tracking your facial movements with no markers on your face, we can make the avatar do just what we're doing. So we're capturing your emotion, your facial expression, and this thing's going to be in the living room, too. Microsoft Kinect is going to be expanded to face. You've probably been seeing some news stories about this. So right now, we've got the ability to capture your face, your emotions, your actions, and put it in a virtual creature. And then the question is, what can you do with that? So I'm done boring with technology. We're going to move on to some more substantial ideas. But I want to take a step back and talk about avatars. And, this word avatar from the movie, we've all heard it. An avatar is simply a virtual representation, that's somebody is controlling. They're moving it around, they're making it talk. And the one I want to focus on here of these stats is the bottom. A recent study by the Kaiser Family Foundation, run by my colleague Don Roberts, in 2005, Don Roberts went on record to Congress. Every 5 years, he runs experiments on people's media use, particularly children between the ages of 6 and 16. And Don went on record in front of Congress and said, children today are using, on average, 7 hours of digital media outside the classroom. This was in 2005. It cannot possibly get higher. He redid this in 2010, and it is now up to 8.5 hours. So think about that. Children sleep. They go to school. In between, they're consuming 8.5 hours of digital media. 2 hours of those are spent playing games that feature avatars. To give you some perspective, if you take the amount of time they spend reading and watching movies, combine them, that's 1 hour. So children in the United States between the ages of 6 and 16 spending twice as much time in avatars as they are reading and watching movies combined. And this is not my study. This is a very well-established government study. But what happens when you're with an avatar? I want to talk about this idea of transformation. When we're face-to-face, what I do, you see. If we're doing a video conference, what I do, you see. If I make a gaffe, if I curse, if I have something in my teeth, you guys see that. With an avatar, my computer can filter the representation. So instead of you seeing me, you all can see an optimal version of me that's been strategically created and sent to each of you to make me an effective person in whatever social context that we're doing. And I know that sounds very abstract right now. What I'm going to do now is take you through a series of dozens of experiments where I've built simulations like the ones I've just described, brought subjects on the order of 100 per experiment in, put them in here, and see what happens. So the first thing we did is I want to talk about how we can influence others. The first thing we did is something called augmented gaze. So psychologists, sociologists, writers have known for a long, long time that other than me poking you, the most powerful nonverbal tool I have is looking at you in the eye. But in this room right now, we have 64 people. I can only look at you in the eye one at a time for less than 2% of this conversation. So I'm limited physically that I can't infuse you with this nonverbal energy enough as a group as I'd like to. In virtual reality, the way it works is that we track people's motions remotely, and then we send their computers automatically send each other the information about behavior, and then everybody draws each other's avatars locally. So just to make that point clear, in a video conference, we send images of what happens. So you'd see a video of this, I would see a video of this. The way VR works, Second Life, any video game that you play, somebody does something, the Kinect will track your motions, emails those motions to the other guy, and the other guy draws what you're doing based on what your computer tells you that you're doing. Okay, is that clear, that difference between that and a video conference? So on the one hand, you see what's going on. On the other hand, my computer tells you the action, and you draw it locally. So what we did is we ran an experiment where what would happen if in VR, because my computer can adjust where my avatar is quote-unquote looking, where you think my avatar is looking, imagine if everyone in this room, while I was giving this talk, had my nonverbal behavior staring at you for a majority of this time. What would happen? So as a teacher, as a salesperson, as a politician, as a persuader, I'm increasing my ability to infuse this group with nonverbal behavior because with literally 10 lines of computer code, every single person just gets my head direction in a different spot. And we ran these experiments. We've run about 4 or 5 experiments testing what happens when teachers get to do this. And 4 things happen. The first thing happens is that people consistently don't like this. Okay? So if I'm giving a talk, and for half of the talk, when there's 64 people in the audience, I'm just looking at one person, people feel a little bit uncomfortable. Okay? It's not humans rarely look at each other for more than 7 seconds at a time in normal conversation. When you really ramp this up, some people feel a little bit weird. But the second thing that occurs is that no one has ever guessed that it's not real gaze. So no one has ever said, well, this guy's teacher staring at me the whole time, but I think it's because somebody's tweaked the gaze. That's never happened. Everyone thinks it's real gaze. The third thing that happens is as a teacher, as a persuader, I want to get your attention. So we measure where everybody's heads are looking when we do these experiments, and these guys look more at me when I've got this super gaze than when I don't. So it could be the case that you don't like the fact that I'm staring at you, but you'll look back at me more than when I do face-to-face normal gaze. The fourth thing that we get is social influence. So we've run experiments on learning, on persuasion. My favorite one is we've got a policy. We ask subjects to sign that says, if you're caught on Stanford's campus without your ID, you're going to be in big trouble. And no one ever wants to sign this document. We're very free and happy, and we don't want to have to do any such restrictions of our liberty. But the odds of a student at Stanford signing this document increases when they receive the gaze that you couldn't give face-to-face, that you can only give non-verbally. So very powerful 10 lines of code that everyone in this room would feel more infused, more persuaded, more likely to buy my book if I had this algorithm now, if we were all in VR. Persuasion is also based on similarity. So one of my favorite studies from the late 90s, a woman named Tanya Chartrand at NYU, she sent people into interviews, and she trained these people face-to-face to mimic the nonverbal gestures of the interviewer. So if the interviewer crossed her legs, then the subject would cross his legs. And if the interviewer, she leaned forward, the subject would do that. And what she demonstrated is that the odds of you of getting this job increase if you mimic compared to other gestures. This was never conscious. This was always an implicit subconscious effect. But by mimicking your gestures, you're going to like me better, think I'm a better person. But remember, how does VR work? VR works because your computer is sending me all this information about your movements so that I can draw you doing it. It's trivial for me to have my computer grab your gestures, turn them around, put my name on it, and send it back to you. So I'm going to show you a video here, very simple video here. This is Nick Yee, a genius that I worked with for many years, who's I'll collaborate on many of these studies. And just watch his head movements. So everything he does, she's persuading him about that same policy, having to carry your ID on Stanford's campus. Everything he does, she's doing at a 4-second lag. So he goes up, 1, 2, 3, 4, her head goes up. So all we're doing is taking his exact movements and sending it back on her at a 4-second lag. It's a slow mirror. Okay? And this is, again, this, as I said, the other one was 10 lines of code. This was literally 4 lines of computer code to make this happen. Not hard to do. What happens? The first thing is we probably run about 600 subjects one at a time in the simulation. Less than 1 in 20 consciously recognizes that their own head movements are being blatantly stolen. So nobody is consciously noticing this. And the people that do, it's because the subject did something like this, okay, and we didn't actually put in a neck muscle that prevents the exorcist from going. So unless somebody really calls it out, we're so in tune with wanting to see ourselves, we don't consciously notice this. The second thing is if I'm mimicking you, you think I'm more intelligent, you think I'm more trustworthy, you're more likely to look at me. And finally, you're more likely to sign this policy, this horrible policy that Stanford students don't want to sign if I'm mimicking you nonverbally compared to if I'm not. So very powerful in the sense that anytime you go online, the web takes cookies. It knows where you've been. It knows what your preferences are. When you're in a virtual environment and a video game or any kind of VR, it takes this to the next level where it captures your gestures and can play them back to you. We've also done this with the face. So I'm going to show you a video here, and I want you to be extremely impressed with this video. And I didn't just choose this because our former governor is depicted in these halls. The reason I want you to be impressed is because this video was made in the year 2003 with software that cost $19. An 18-year-old communication major made this video in 20 minutes with zero training. So why I want you to be impressed is because this is trivial to do. So I'm going to show this to you again. A simple pixel blending, morphing from one image to the other. So all we're doing here is changing one face to another and doing it very subtly. Okay? And we wanted to ask the question, I know that in the physical world, if I look more like you, you're going to like me better. So NVIDIA has demonstrated that if I'm laying on the ground clutching my knee in agony, the odds of you coming to help me increase if I look like you. A recent study by Lisa de Bruin in England, if you look more like me, I'm more likely to hand my children over to you for you to babysit them. Okay, big stuff happens. We think of ourselves as these spiritual, self-actualized, rational beings, but little surface stuff matters a lot. But remember, in VR, your face is a 3D model. I have access to every single point and pixel on there, and I can make my face look more like yours. So here is a version of me from 2004, before I got tenure, nice and clean cut, you see. This is a picture of George W. Bush. And over here is the blend that is 60% George Bush and 40% me. Okay? So in 2003, what we did is we ran an experiment where we paid a focus group company a lot of money to get a national random sample. We had 200 people from across the country, various socioeconomic statuses, etc. And what we did is we sent them versions of Bush and Kerry side by side. And for a third of the subject, their own face was morphed with George Bush at a 40% level. For a third of the subjects, their face was morphed with Kerry at a 40% level. And then for a third of the subjects, they got the normal pictures of Bush and Kerry. So the voter looked like Bush, the voter looked like Kerry, or they saw the normal pictures. And we acquired these photographs passively about 6 months beforehand. A week before the election happened, we asked them who you're going to vote for. Okay. Now let me tell you that we've now had to replicate the study 5 times, and not a replicate meaning run it again and again in different elections. In 1,200 people, not a single person, when we asked them to write a detailed paragraph about the pictures of Bush and Kerry, not a single person has consciously recognized that their own face is in there. Nobody. As long as you stay under 40%, no one knows that 40% of their face has been put into this candidate. But what did we demonstrate? In the control condition where it looked it was a normal Bush and Kerry, we replicated the outcomes of the election. It was 46-44. When the self is morphed with Bush, Bush wins in a landslide by 13 points. When the self is morphed with Kerry, Kerry wins by 7 points. We swapped the results of who people were going to vote for based on a subconscious similarity to the candidate. So you're all looking at this and you're saying, I don't believe that. And when we got this results, we were very excited as scientists, very depressed as citizens. And we sent it to the best journal in political science. This is my colleague, Shantoo Iyengar, a very big one in political science. And the editor rejected it without even looking at it. He said, voters are rational. They don't make decisions based on this. And for us to publish this, we literally had to redo the experiment 5 or 6 times. It's one of the strongest effects that we've gotten. Making the self look more like someone else is a really powerful tool for people trying to persuade you. And to do it technologically in the virtual world, it's trivial. So I'm going to shift a little bit about what happens. So hopefully now I've convinced you a little bit that when I transform myself, it changes my ability to persuade you guys. What I want to talk about is, well, what's the cost to me? We said that kids are spending 2 hours a day inside avatars. What is that doing to them when they're looking and behaving in ways virtually that they could never do physically? And the way that we ask this question is we look what's called the virtual mirror. So here is Nick Yee, and he's walking around in the virtual world. We're tracking his movements. It's a very nice looking hotel room. He walks up to a virtual mirror. And subjects typically will spend 90 seconds gesturing in front of this mirror, and you really feel a connection. You feel that it's yourself. It feels very strong because it moves with you in the mirror. He's a white male in the mirror, and then he ducks down, and we hit a button. And when he comes up, he's now a woman of color. Okay? And the question we ask, from a psychological standpoint, when your avatar is of a fundamental separate social category than you are, how does that affect the way you behave? Do you behave like your physical self, or do you shift to be more like your virtual self? And that's a driver for a number of studies that I'm going to rush you through. And the first thing, so the way that this works, that this is the typical experiment. The subject looks in the mirror, sees himself for 90 seconds, and then talks to someone else. This is the confederate. This is the person whose job it is to talk to the subject, who says the same thing every time. And I want to talk about two studies that we've run. The first is attractiveness. In the physical world, being attractive correlates with self-esteem, with extroversion. Again, we like to think that deepness matters, and it does, but it turns out if you're good-looking, it changes how you behave. So we put people in good-looking avatars. They spent 90 seconds looking at themselves in the mirror in avatars that were attractive or less attractive, and then the Confederate says, hey, come on over here. And three things happen. The first is that when you have an attractive avatar, you'll step 1 meter closer to the Confederate than when you have an unattractive avatar. So on an implicit level, you feel comfortable and confident, and you'll invade that person's personal space. None of our subjects consciously knew they were the attractive one. It was very subtle, actually, one standard deviation in terms of attractiveness ratings. So you'll step closer to this guy. You look him more in the eye, and we record everyone's speech, and then we send it to nonverbal experts, and we have these experts rate the speech patterns for confidence, socialness, and for openness. And when you have an attractive avatar, it actually changes the way you speak. You're more likely to be personable and nice, and you speak. So very powerful data there. The second study we ran was height. So in the physical world, income is correlated with height in the United States. The taller you are, the more money you make. A fairly depressing study that came out of the University of Chicago, they got back-end data of online dating sites, and they could do actuarial math by looking at how many clicks you got for dates. And it turns out that for men, every inch you are under 5'10", you've got to earn an extra $30,000 to get the same number of clicks. So even in the virtual world, height matters. And so what Nick wanted to do in these studies is he wanted to say, well, in VR, height is free. You can be 1,000 feet tall as easily as you can be 6 feet tall as 4 feet. What happens if I just make you 10 centimeters taller than the Confederate or 10 centimeters shorter than the Confederate. And what he did is he put them in these avatars and he gave them a money-splitting task, where he actually had them split real money and a classic business school negotiation task. And what he found is, regardless of your physical height, when my avatar is shorter than yours, I am three times as likely to lose the negotiation. Okay? Three times as likely to lose negotiation with real money. Both these studies might sound a little bit hokey, but they've been replicated a number of times, published in very prestigious journals. So we are very confident in these effects. The question that everybody asks at this point is, that's fine, but what happens when I leave? Right? So I don't spend time in VR. I don't negotiate in VR. What happens when I leave? And so Nick ran a few clever studies looking about how it extends to face-to-face. So with the attractiveness study, if you spent half an hour in an attractive avatar, and then we take you out of VR, pay you for the experiment, and then you go down four flights of stairs, we walk you down, and right as you're about to run out the door, we have a PhD student run and grab you and say, please, please don't leave. I need to finish my dissertation. If you fill out this form, it's going to take you 5 minutes. I'll give you $10. So nobody has any idea it's got anything to do with our study. And part of this task is you're put in a dating situation and you've got to pick people that you think would go out with you. So you're trying to pick people with whom you have a shot. And if you've had an attractive avatar an hour earlier, you're more likely to pick better-looking people in the physical world than if you've had an unattractive avatar. So this confidence boost you get in the virtual world actually changes your physical social behavior. With the height study, Nick ran an experiment where you had the height differential, and then he took you out of VR. You never saw each other physically, and he put you in chairs that guaranteed your heights were exactly equal. He then had you redo the negotiation, and it turns out that you get the exact same results. So this hierarchy that forms in the virtual world based on your height differential actually changes your negotiation behavior subsequently based on that factor. So I want to talk about another line of studies very quickly, and I like to call these déjà vu. It feels like I've never been here before. And this takes the big idea of the Orville Redenbacher. So what if Orville was still alive, and he got to see himself from the third person doing something that he's never physically done? So think about that. As humans, we have never yet had this experience ever. You can look in the mirror and see yourself move around. You can watch a videotape of yourself doing something you've done previously, but never before in the history of humankind have we been able to see ourselves engaging in a physical action that we've never done before. And what can you do with this? And it turns out there's a lot. So in this video here, the avatar looks just like the person who's wearing this helmet. Every three times his knees cross his waist, his avatar loses a pound. So what he's seeing is the physical consequences of exercise. He's seeing his avatar lose weight as he exercises. And you're really seeing the connection between physical activity and health. We then force him to stand still, and the weight comes back on. And I can tell you personally that this is one of the more powerful experiences. Seeing yourself looks just like you in the third person, gaining weight and then losing weight. What we've demonstrated in our studies is that in the next 24 hours, people that engage in the simulation will exercise an hour more in that day than compared to lots of control conditions. And when we give you the opportunity, we can say, hey, you know what? The lab's not closing for half an hour. If you want to just hang out, work out, you can. People will sit there and run in place in the lab after doing this. I mean, a way of thinking about avatars is it's a way to change these entrenched, really hard to change in behavior. Everyone knows you're supposed to exercise, but sometimes you need a visceral, embodied experience to show you how it helps, and that's what we've done with our health. We've also run studies where we force you to watch yourself eating Reese's Pieces and you see your thighs spread and your gut grow and showing pretty drastic changes to your eating behaviors later on. On the negative side, my student Catherine Segovia was brave enough to bring in 100 preschoolers into my lab and put my $40,000 helmet on each of their heads. And she wanted to ask the question, when you see yourself doing something in the third person, does that become memory? So in this, the legal literature, there's a fairly large amount of experimentation on when children form false memories. And what Catherine did is she brought in our kids and showed them themselves that looked just like them swimming with Fudgy the Whale. Okay, so they either saw themselves swimming with Fudgy the Whale, or they saw a child of the same gender that looked like them, or they imagined it. And what we demonstrated in our studies, when we brought kids back a week later, people who saw themselves swimming with whales, 50% of our children formed false memories, meaning they would tell you that they'd been to SeaWorld, that they jumped in the tank, what it smelled like, the hot dog they ate beforehand. They had created a false memory based around this virtual experience. So very powerful in that sense. We've run a series of studies on self-endorsing, which takes the big idea that science fiction people have known for a long time. What if you were driving down the street and a camera caught your face, and then you got around the corner and the billboard showed you using a product? Turns out video games are doing this all the time, having your arms display product advertisements. And what we've demonstrated is that when the self, if you show someone themselves in third person using a product and having great things happen because of this product use, for example, people who you think are attractive are, you know, running toward you, a month later, you're much more likely to prefer that product, even though you don't remember consciously the connection to why you do. And finally, a study that we've run that's received a lot of attention recently has to do with a connection with the future self. So we brought in 18-year-olds, and it turns out there's a crisis in this country. 18-year-olds are not saving any money. People in their early 20s are not saving any money. And the math people have said, we are in big, big trouble, because when they grow up, they are going to not have any savings. So we posit that part of the reason this occurs is because people don't have a connection with their future self. So when I was 18, I couldn't even imagine what it's like to be 30, let alone when I was going to be 65. So what we do in these studies is we take your face and we show you yourself in the mirror, and if you can see this, we use aging algorithms so that an 18-year-old can see himself in the mirror as if he were 65, our projection of what he's going to look like when he's 65. And what we then do is we give him the option of having a little bit of money now, or if he puts it in savings, more money later. And people are more likely to defer gratification when you give them this embodied experience of occupying their future self compared to anything else that we've done in the lab. So again, think of VR as a way to change very difficult to change behaviors. No one wants to save money. Undergrads want to spend it on beer. But we can make them not spend it on beer and put it in retirement savings if you show them what their future self is going to look like. But they'll really like this. So it'll be okay. And I want to close briefly spending about 3 minutes talking about some work that I'm very, very excited about. And it really is about this idea of empathy, and it's about, can you make somebody have a better understanding for others if you have them walk in someone else's shoes? So the aging study that I talked about, a separate study that we ran, is it turns out young people are ageist, meaning the same way you can be sexist or racist, an 18-year-old has got pretty harsh opinions about someone who's 65. If you have them embody the experience of being older, those stereotypes go away. And so as a tool for diversity training, I've had many industry people approach me for various reasons. One of my favorite ones to talk about is a Silicon Valley company that's asked me to build software to train for diversity. And the way you do that is, well, let's not tell you to imagine what it would be like to have this happen, but let's throw them in a simulation and cause them to feel that way. And getting very excited about that. One of my favorite studies is we're really trying to use the lab's resources to try to make people more energy conscious and to save environmental degradation. And so in this study, there was a nice op-ed in the New York Times a few years back that said that if you use that beautiful, fluffy, comfortable tissue paper, that toilet paper that's not recycled, if you're using that non-recycled paper, you're basically cutting down between 2 and 4 virgin trees over the course of your life. That op-ed, probably a lot of us read it and just kind of threw the paper aside. What we did is we ran an experiment where we told everyone these statistics, and half of our subjects read a passage about what it would be like to have to cut down those trees in order to make the tissue paper. The other half wore the helmet, went into this beautiful forest virtually where they could see the birds, used what we call a haptic device that shakes our hands like this, and we forced them to cut down 2 trees. Okay, very powerful experience. Recent people that I've had in the lab have told me that this has stayed with them for weeks and weeks. The critical dependent variable that we used in this one, my PhD student Grace Ahn, very clever woman, she was visibly pregnant at the time. And an hour after they got this experience, what she does is she knocks down a glass of water. And she says, oh, I need help. Can you please help me clean it up? Of course, everyone rushes to help her. We have a preset number of napkins that are on the table, and we count how many napkins subjects use to clean the spill. So it turns out you'll use 20% less paper when you've gotten this virtual experience compared to other control conditions. So again, the really hard to change behaviors we're very excited about. We've tracked their behavior over time, and they're reporting that they're using less paper. So very, very excited about the idea of using avatars to make people more energy conscious. We've also been looking into disability. So here's a simple example of, in VR, it's very trivial to manage color. What we had is we had our subjects, we literally robbed the ability to differentiate red from green. So in this room, statistically, we've probably got 3 of you that are red, green, colorblind. And we just wanted to say, well, I can tell you what it's like to be colorblind, or I can put you in the helmet and make it so you can only see colors where you can't see difference in red and green. And what we then do, so you've either read about what it's like to be colorblind, or we've literally made you colorblind. And then after the experiment's over, we give you the option to stick after the lab on your own time and help put in your time towards finding websites that are going to be to show which ones are going to be hard for colorblind people to read. When you get VR, you spend half an hour of your own time sitting in the lab helping other people compared to when you've read a description of what it would be like. So again, this embodiment, this experience of being in this virtual space, changing your behavior for the better, nobody wants to give up their own time. So we're very excited about this. So I've spoken very quickly at you guys, and I want to talk with you guys. So to conclude, avatars make us more human than human. They give us the ability to do things we could never do in the physical world, but it is a little creepy. I like to close by saying, you know, you'll read about this in the book. I am not one of these people that says everybody should use VR and it's going to save the world. I'm not one of these people that says VR is going to kill our children and you should avoid it at all costs. I am saying that VR is going to qualitatively change what it means to be a person and what it means to have social interaction. And the world that we're going to see in the next few years is going to be fascinating, scary, and just really different. So I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to Professor Bailenson for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Infinite Reality with Jeremy Bailenson. So now we open the floor to a Q&A session. I'll be passing around the microphone. If you have a question, please raise your hand, wait until you have the microphone, and then speak into the microphone.
I have a thought that came up as you were talking about being able to capture someone's image and basically creating an avatar that's very lifelike. Theoretically, you could create a video of that person committing a crime and use that to convict the person of a crime they never did, right?
And you can create a false memory of it. They actually believe
it. Yes and yes. Again, this is a subtitle that we ended up eliminating for the book is A Brave New World. And yes, given the technology I have in my lab, I could build a version of you that looks just like you, show you committing a heinous crime, and broadcast that to the world. Now, the horrible thing about that is that you can tell someone rationally that it wasn't you, but the emotional connection that someone else is going to have when they see you face to face after watching your avatar do something horrible is pretty, you know, it's pretty powerful. And you take people, you know, these actors, for example, Brad Pitt in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. They created an avatar of him for that movie that is so detailed he never needs to act again. At that level, you can create a video of him doing anything.
Who owns your avatar?
I'm in touch on a daily basis with probably the most leading legal scholar of virtual worlds on the planet, and she has no idea. They are so far behind the laws of this. It's just, you know, is it intellectual property? Is it physical property? They just don't know. So, part of the book, we have a list of six ways to kind of manage your digital footprint. And, you know, it's up to you. It's not there. You can't ask for protection from others because there are no rules. It's a wild, wild west out there.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Susie. Thank you so much for coming.
Susie, thank you.
So I'm fascinated by what you're doing, and I'm really, really excited. Mm-hmm. I want to figure out how I can participate, but I was wondering if you have worked in the areas of, say, social anxieties, as well as someone just touched on this right now, and you did, in terms of, like, committing a crime or something like that, but the walking in someone else's shoes, what about the experience of being the victim? You know, for instance, like the Catholic Church and what they're up to,
What?
Like the Catholic Church and what they're up to, right? All the priests molesting all the little boys and things like that. You know, they don't go to prison, right? But what if they could have this experience of what it's like to, you know, have your childhood stolen?
Let me touch first on the less controversial thing you said, which is can we use this to treat social anxiety? And there is a fairly large economic, you know, there's three ways VR is making money right now, and one of them is treating phobias. And who was it? I think it was Seinfeld that said that most people would rather be in the coffin than speak at a funeral. Americans have a real fear of public speaking. And there's at Stanford, I have a colleague named James Gross. He's an emotional psychologist. And we built a simulation where a room just like this, where I can dial up how rude you guys are. Okay, so in the good condition, you guys are being just like you've been tonight. Fantastic. Just a pleasure, a treat to be in front of. In the bad condition, the guys in the back are saying, you suck! And people are looking at their watches, and they're getting very bored. And we've used this as a way to, you know, so the way you treat phobias is something called systematic desensitization. Slowly expose them to something over and over again. They conquer their fear and give the subject, the speaker, the power to dial up and down how scary and not scary it is. And it's a nice use of the technology. We have, when I first started doing the diversity training stuff,
Did you say systematic exposure? Is that what you just said?
Systematic desensitization. Yep. And that's in, we do a lot of that in chapter 11 in the book, in the chapter called Virtually Useful.
I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm familiar with the virtual reality desensitization procedures. And primarily, they focus on visual movement. But as a psychophysiologist, I look at other physiological representations that aren't immediately accessible to a camera. So heart rate, blood pressure changes, sweat gland. If those, they are measurable in transmitters that could be sent to a receiver that could be integrated into a virtual reality picture. Is there any movement in the direction of a more comprehensive representation of what the person is or what you would like them to become?
So my co-author, Jim Blaskovich, is a psychophysiologist, so I'm very familiar with this work. And we just finished running a study where we just took the simple, so we took a commercial wristwatch that cost $100 that can measure your heart rate, and we just gave the ability of one person to see the other person's heart. And how does that change my level of intimacy toward you when I see your heartbeat? So right now I get markers of your heart rate. I see if you blush. I can see if you sweat. But what happens in a real-time interaction when VR gives me an extra channel? I get to see a part of you that I wouldn't see otherwise. And we've demonstrated that people demonstrate higher levels of intimacy subsequently when you get to see the heartbeat than when not. So it's a really neat direction to go in. Thank you.
For years, we've had a debate, or have heard in the news, a debate between video game producers and those who say that the violence in video games will lead to that similar action in the players themselves. And that debate seems to be going on. And we know that the person who committed the heinous crime in Norway played video games, violent video games. And based on your research, it seems to me that there's no debate anymore that that doing actions in virtual reality will lead you to do those actions in reality, or makes it easier for you to do them in reality because you're desensitized to the results, to the actions. Any comments on?
Well, so I agree with your claim that the literature of the 1,000 studies that have been done about does video games cause violence versus does it act as a catharsis, relieving you of this violent urge, 99% of them say that you do model. So I'm not an anti-video game person myself, but it's hard to argue with that data. What we've demonstrated is something called immersion. So when you're playing a video game, it's a 2D screen. You're controlling it with this little joystick. What happens when it's a 3D hologram right there? You get spatialized sound. You've got a virtual touch device where you feel the blood splatter on you, and you're controlling it in a naturalistic manner. This is called immersion. This is what makes VR VR. It feels like you're actually in there. You feel you can't tell it's not real, just like that guy in the pit. And what we've demonstrated is that when you get a violent video game in an immersive context, that it magnifies what we call the modeling effect. So the odds of you modeling that violent behavior increases when it's immersive compared to when it's just this kind of abstract 2D thing. So if anything, if you're scared about video game violence, you should be really scared about VR video game violence.
Is the military interested in this technology?
So early on, pretty much the only way to get a grant in VR was through the military back in the late 80s. They still remain extremely interested. In chapter 10 in the book, we have something called digital footprints. And we talk specifically about a branch of the military called the IARPA, which has put out a call to our resources to using something called the digital footprint. So whenever you're in VR, you leave data behind, how you walked, where you looked, what you said. And the military, and I think in a good way, I'm not actually anti-military at all, is coming up with mechanisms of using this digital footprint to determine your identity. And I've got colleagues working on these projects that can predict, based on what you're doing in this online world called Second Life or a game called World of Warcraft, can predict your gender, your race with very high levels of precision just based on how you're moving around in the virtual world. So they remain interested, I guess, is a way of answering that question. But I mean, at this point, any serious industry has to be interested in this technology. It's kids are spending 2 hours a day in avatars. You can't claim that you're a serious person in the society we have without spending some time with this stuff. Yeah.
So I started playing World of Warcraft when it came out, and I played a girl character. Mm. And the reason I did so is because I thought I wanted to look at a girl. And this is a third-person experience. So mm-hmm. have you studied the effect of first-person versus third-person on immersion? That's the first question. And then the second question, sorry, is I noticed immediately that people treated me like a girl. Mm. And
can't imagine why.
And yeah, and then I started acting nicer back.
Yeah, yeah.
They were acting nicer to me, and I was acting nicer to them.
Yeah.
And that worked for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone discovered that there were way too many girls.
Yeah.
In the game. Based on then people were talking over voice chat and things like that, and there were not as many girls. So people got savvy to the effect, and then it totally went away. So how many of these effects that you study go away when people become savvy to them?
So lots of stuff I could talk about there. To be brief in the answer, on the first version versus third, there's been about 16 experiments on this. I just a month ago sat on a dissertation that brutally reviewed every one of them. The data is very mixed on that. I don't think there's a clear answer, and I'd love to tell you there was, but that's very mixed. In terms of the female versus male, there are about three experiments out there that show. So Nick Yee got back-end data of World of Warcraft, and he showed that he actually had men when they had male avatars, and the same men when they had female avatars. And what he demonstrated is that when men are wearing their female body, they're more nurturing. They're more likely to help other people as opposed to fight even the same person when they're male and female. So as a tool to treating towards creating a nurturing type person, this male to female avatars works quite well. About the does it wear off, in all of our data, every experiment that I told you about, everything was implicit, meaning it was subtle and subconscious. If you know that someone's mimicking you or you know that someone stole your face, it backfires drastically. So the best thing that I can do, I don't sell any of this stuff. Political consultants call me. I don't work with them. My job is to create awareness and to make sure that you guys know that this stuff is a possibility and to help you manage your digital footprint. But were you spending over 20 hours a week in World of Warcraft? I don't want to know. Okay.
So avatars don't look exactly like you. They're pretty close.
Right.
And so I'm wondering what will happen with so many people using and looking at avatars over time. Will people become less sensitive overall to the differences between their avatar and the real person, like the studies they showed that people who listen to MP3s, which is lower quality audio than something that's not compressed, those folks lost the sensitivity to tell the difference? Or will it be like in the social setting, like in World of Warcraft, where because of some secondary effects of there being too many women, suddenly people are going to have a better, higher awareness of this is likely not to be the truth when they're looking at someone?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. My favorite study that addresses this, my colleague Jeff Hancock at Cornell ran a study where he, forget avatars in the interactive sense, he just got your dating profile, which is just like you're saying. It's a fidelity. And he wanted to find out how much your profile actually looked like you. So he paid people from Match.com. He paid them $100. They came in the lab, and he weighed them, measured their height, looked at their W-2s to see how much money they made, and basically looked at the amount of deception that was there. And he had a funny title to his paper. It was that people lie just enough to get laid. This is a circuitous answer to your question, which is even in online social networking, we've got a tolerance for incongruity between the self and the virtual self. And as it gets to be more avatar-based, there's no empirical answer to your question. What my gut says is, yeah, we're not going to care so much about do you look like this today or this tomorrow. That's a great way to think about it.
Not what we care, but we'll be able to distinguish if we do care.
Oh, so will we lose the ability to determine someone's face? Yeah, it's a big question. We'll try to answer that over time. That's great. Thank you.
So I guess just two more questions. Okay, you earned a double.
I've always read that a lot of communication is nonverbal. Mm-hmm. In fact, maybe most of communication is nonverbal. how much of that are avatars able to capture? Because when I look at the avatar, it's impressive, but I know it's not human. So is something being lost there? And have you done studies to see if this communication that's not happening?
Right. So two answers to that. The first is every year, more and more nonverbal behaviors are able to be tracked and rendered. So the next product after the Kinect is going to be able to put your face in it's not face-to-face sensitive, which is extremely sensitive, but it's going to get more and more like that. The second answer is that there's a fair amount of experiments. A guy named Joe Walther at Michigan State shows that when you reduce the number of nonverbal cues you have, you just put more weight on the ones that are there. Right. So think about if you're playing a game of Pac-Man, all you'd have, you have 2 degrees of freedom, up and down. Not much. When you have an avatar in Second Life, it can do 7 or 8 gestures. When you're using the Kinect, it's up to 20. The fewer there are, the more you pay attention to the ones that are there. And people evolve pretty well at putting more weight on the channels that exist. And they could be the wrong channels. We have one of my favorite, I could show you this video. So imagine we attract 22 points in the face to make that avatar work with you. Instead of showing you a human face, we've built an emota box that changes color, shape, and orientation randomly based on those facial movements. And we just stick people in a two-way conversation and have them communicate with this colored box that moves in weird ways. Over time, you'd be surprised how well they get at picking up really subtle emotions with this weird box that just kind of moves with their face.
So looking forward, how do you start to deal with some of these ethical issues, and who does it? Who's going to deal with this sort of stuff 10 years from now or 5 years from now?
My job is to jump up and down, rant and rave, and make sure that the right people are getting awareness on this.
And who are they?
The people in this group, there's two ways of thinking this, and let's try to get the government to do something, or can we manage our own digital footprint? And so one piece of tangible advice I can give to everyone in this room right now that may make your life much better in 5 years is if you've got pictures of yourself on Facebook with your face being 1,200 pixels by 1,000 pixels of just this part of your face, you don't need that much resolution. You're just giving someone the opportunity to grab your face and use it. So just take off those high-res pictures of your face. That's a simple thing you can do. But look, I talk to a lot of people. The NIH comes to my lab all the time. The military comes to my lab all the time. I've got delegations from foreign nations there on a weekly basis. And my job is to let people know how wonderful and how potentially scary this stuff is and hope the right person gets the message. Because I don't think adults are fully grasping the amount of time kids are spending in these worlds and the amazing and horrific things that can occur in them. And my job is to try to make that message clear.
It would seem like with the coming immersion VR that today on computing networks, I guess there's a lot of time spent with more of the negative aspects that it can do. Mm. When you weigh it with the positive, is that true or am I off with that?
I hope that I didn't give that impression. So, I mean, think about the environmental changes that we did, the diversity training, feeling like you're someone else, the teachers that get to look at all their students at once. I want to focus on them as much as I'm focusing on the addictive nature, the violent nature, the ability to persuade you to vote for me even though you don't want to, which are as equally negative as the other ones. But I do think there's wonderful ones, too. In the book, we've got a chapter called The Yin and the Yang of these interactions where we try to keep it balanced. But we try to say any technology is something we call dual use. It can be great stuff and horrible stuff. Think uranium. It can heat your home. It can destroy a nation. And
it sounds like it's going to reach a whole new level with the immersion thing, which would be a whole new level of interaction. Which
in my humble opinion, absolutely.
May have huge consequences.
Yeah, that's what I believe. The areas that are money-making are entertainment, huge, right? I mean, virtual therapy is a big one. Training, so yes, about the military simulations, war games, things like that. Marketing is a big one. I don't know of many politicians doing much. So if you take what Obama did, which is leverage social media, then if you keep VR loose, then yeah, it helps in politics. But and there's some people that do some events in worlds like Second Life, but hasn't really grokked that large. On the public relations sides of things, again, I know that politicians, Sarah Palin, will go into Second Life every once in a while and talk and to try to spread the message. I don't think that's become a staple. When you really expand it out and talk about Twitter, obviously, it's reaching lots of people. But I do think that the politicians, I was on sabbatical last year, spent a year in D.C., and when I come to this part of the world and talk about this stuff, it's a pleasure. You guys all get it. In D.C., they're a little bit behind the times in terms of these technologies. So I've thrown around the word Kinect, Second Life, Nintendo Wii in this crowd, and you all get it. In D.C., they're still, at least I had a red tie and a blue shirt. I was okay.
Okay. Our thanks to Professor Bailenson for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to and viewing this program. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For joining us this evening. We have the books available for purchase out there, so if you'd like to purchase your copy, please do so. And also, Professor Bailenson is so gracious as to stay and field your questions and also sign your books. Thank you.